Hey, this is Kyle Clark. You're listening to the podcast version of Next. Catch us live weeknights at 6 Mountain Time on 9 News and streaming live same time on 9 News Plus. Email me anytime at next@9news.com.
How much more water would you save if you knew you'd get paid for it? The federal government is preparing to send $100 million to Colorado and three other states to pay water users to conserve. As the drought impacts the Colorado River, the program would incentivize ranchers, farmers, and the entire state to use less. Mark Salinger looks into the plan that's still short on specifics.
In a state where nearly everyone has been asked to conserve water, now there's a plan to pay some people to use less. A new program led by the state and funded by the Bureau of Reclamation would send a total of $100 million to Colorado, New Mexico, Utah, and Wyoming, the four Upper Colorado River Basin states. The money would pay farmers, ranchers, and cities to voluntarily use less water, as the federal government uses incentives to try and grow water levels in reservoirs like Lake Powell.
That is not just flowing downstream to the lower basin, but rather it is being used to the credit of the upper basin to build resiliency.
Amy Osteich is a section chief with the Colorado Water Conservation Board. They're calling it a near-term contribution program. Saved water would be credited to Colorado and the other upper basin states and stored in reservoirs like Lake Powell or Blue Mesa here in Colorado. The state has paid water users to conserve water before, but in past programs, no one tracked where that saved water actually went once it left the state. This time, officials say they'll know.
So it would be the first time that there is a contribution, like conservation, you know, program established.
But there are still a lot of questions. States would have to account for how much water is saved and who saved it. A challenging task. It's still not clear how the money would be split up or how much each state would get. It's also unknown even how much water the state could actually conserve in a year when water is already hard to come by.
The way that we conserve water looks a little bit different up here. In wetter years, we'll have more water to conserve. In dry years like this, I don't know how many water rights holders are going to have water that they could contribute to a program like this, to be honest.
Nothing has been signed yet either, but Colorado says that the feds have told them that they intend to make this program a reality. They say this agreement would run parallel to any new operating rules that are agreed upon or imposed for the Colorado River as a whole. The rules that govern the river expire at the end of September, and the seven states that have that use the river have not yet been able to come to an agreement so far, blowing past several important deadlines, Marshall.
I'm naive to not know if Denver Water gets water from the Colorado River. Am I a Colorado River user? Could I earn money for conserving?
So everything that we've heard so far is that this is going to be on a bigger scale. Farmers, agriculture, ranchers, things like that use a lot of water. But this is also back to the short on specifics part.
Sure.
We still don't know specifically who is going to have access to these funds or where the money's going to go.
But we also learned Marshall is selfish about wanting to...
Just send it the $100 million to Marshall.
Right. Ranchers and farmers deserve the money for saving. Thank you, Mark. It's common for bills passed by the state legislature to take effect months after the governor signs them. A bill passed by Democrats last year to restrict certain guns takes effect next weekend, but that may not do much to actually restrict those guns. The original intent for Democratic State Senator Tom Sullivan was to ban guns with detachable magazines. His son, Alex, was killed in the Aurora Theater shooting 14 years ago, where the shooter had a 100-round drum magazine. The next year, in 2013, state Democrats banned magazines that hold more than 15 rounds, but our own 9 News investigation years later proved that that law did not stop the sale of those types of magazines. Sullivan's original bill was not going to get signed by Democratic Governor Jared Polis, so it got changed. Starting next month, someone can still buy or sell a gun that accepts detachable magazines if they take a safety course set up through Colorado Parks and Wildlife.
What we're looking to do is make detachable magazines obsolete. The governor and his team came in the last hours before we were ready to go to the Senate floor and wanted to do this permit to purchase and making people go through extra steps to be able to circumvent and still have the ability to buy an assault-style weapon with detachable magazines.
The new law does not impact owners of guns with detachable magazines bought or sold prior to August 1st. Any sales going forward after that date, you'll have to take a safety course and pay a $52 fee to CPW and a fee to your local sheriff's office and a fee to the specific safety course you take. As Americans debate the merits of the president's pledge to oversee the largest deportation effort in U.S. history, few know of what ICE is doing before hundreds of thousands of people are removed from the country. Critics call them shuffle flights. With the help of our sister stations across the country, reporter Chris Vanderveen was able to put some of the pieces together of this often misunderstood system by taking a look at one day in America.
Across American skies, over cities big and small, every day the planes move thousands from one spot in the U.S. to another. To understand how it works, we decided to follow one plane on one day. Multiple stops, multiple locations, multiple crews.
People don't realize what's happening in our community.
Our day started in eastern Ohio.
People don't feel it, they don't see it.
In Youngstown.
This is what our country is doing. This is what's happening.
This 737, operated by Eastern Air Express, is one part of a massive ICE air fleet.
They have progressively moved the planes behind the airport.
Here, we met Chris Harris, part of an informal national network of observers who document the flights.
And at this point now, they're pulling the loading ramps to block any kind of visuals.
On its webpage, Immigration and Customs Enforcement says that detainees may be transferred to other facilities to eliminate overcrowding or meet special detainee needs.
Two flights a day, leaving Youngstown in the morning.
We don't know who boarded this flight or why they boarded. ICE will not discuss ongoing or future operations, citing security concerns. We do know, based on our reporting, this flight went by the flight number Tyson 57. We know that because we built our own database using downloadable but little-known flight information to find the flights and planes used by ICE Air operations. From Ohio, Tyson 57 traveled east to Bedford, Massachusetts.
If you told me a year ago that I'd be doing this, I would say you're crazy.
This is where Todd Palmer, another observer, waited. He understands more than most. ICE doesn't like to advertise where it goes.
What we're seeing here is a piece of a nationwide, giant-scale, secret operation whisking people around the country and then out of the country.
Much like celebrities or wealthy jet-setters who want to keep their travels private, ICE uses a federal system known as LAD, or Limiting Aircraft Data Displayed, to remove many of its flights from many flight tracking websites. They're not invisible to radar, but if you looked up this plane on flightaware.com on this day, for example, you would have never seen it, and thus would have missed its third stop in Indianapolis, Indiana. Here, another crew of ours recorded detainees boarding Tyson 57 in leg and arm shackles. ICE calls the restraints standard protocol and an essential measure to ensure the safety and well-being of both detainees and officers' agents accompanying them.
We're just seeing that these flights are kind of crisscrossing our country.
Savi Arvi works for Human Rights First, an immigrant advocacy group that monitors what some call shuffle flights, these domestic-only transfers.
Everyone should care about these flights in particular.
She worries flights intended to assist with deportation also appear to be doing something else.
The flights within the United States often shuffle people between detention centers and deportation facilities, sometimes with little explanation.
These aren't just city-by-city pickups of prisoners, she says. To her, it's a deliberate government plan to play keep away.
And I think there are great concerns that these flights are then taking people away from their attorneys.
When it comes to ICE air operations, no place plays a larger role than Alexandria, Louisiana, a town of less than 50,000 that sits in a parish that voted 2-1 in favor of President Donald Trump.
Just a lot of people feel that this is what they voted for, so they're pleased.
She doesn't want us to use her name, mostly because of where she lives and what she does.
They will open the doors and all these people will start pouring out in shackles and just like shuffling. You'll see them line up and they just keep coming.
This is the nation's busiest ICE Air hub. It sits just beyond the back nine of the Oakwing Golf Club.
You can come out here any day of the week and you're gonna witness flights.
On this day, it was also Tyson 57's fourth stop. One flight, one day, 2,000 miles, dozens of detainees picked up and shipped south. Every stop raised the same questions. Who was ICE moving and why? In 2023, the then acting ICE director in front of Congress estimated these charter flights run $17,000 an hour. This day's journey, 7 hours. By that estimation, 119,000 from start to finish. And Tyson 57 was hardly alone that day. We identified, tracked, traced 65 flights in all. A vast daily network few know, and even fewer understand.
People deserve to know what happens to them, not to disappear into the black hole.
And most of these flights, as you can see, never left the country.
All week, we'll air more of Chris's extensive investigation into a multi-state network of deportation flights. But you can watch the full documentary, ICE Air, Inside America's Secret Deportation Network, on the 9 News app. The Western Slope has been waiting for rain, just not like this. Flash flooding and mudslides have shut down parts of I-70.
This is how we provide community to our neighbors, is gathering them at the table.
And a nonprofit in Denver's Sun Valley neighborhood is fighting inflation at the grocery store with a no-cost grocery program. That's next. I've been watching the 7-day forecast, counting down the days until the rain comes, and Chris Bianchi has told me the monsoon is monsooning already. But parts of the state that have been without rain for so long, wanting the rain, comes with some flash flooding risk, like the mudslide that shut down I-70 on the Western Slope last night. The highway is still closed in both directions just west of Glenwood Springs, though the detour is Highway 6, which is parallel to I-70. CDOT says mud and debris covered the road between the Silt exit and Newcastle. They say the mud and debris was more than 3 feet deep in some spots. Chris Bianchi is here. I stole your line about monsooning.
It's okay.
Are we going to talk about the snow? Are we moving ahead to that?
We're going straight to the rain here, okay. Marshall, because the monsoon, it is monsooning. And in some cases here, Marshall, we've seen already a good inch or two of rain in southwest Colorado, while in parts of northwest Colorado, including just the southwest of Craig, there's a notable new fire start as well. So the monsoon, this is classic. It's hit or miss where you get underneath one of these downpours. You've got flash flood warnings. You've got in purple here all those flash flood warnings for Montezuma and Dolores counties, the southwest corner of the state. I was looking at some of the rain observations from here. Some spots have picked up about an inch and a half of rain, and that is over the Ferris Fire burn scars. So just keep in mind with the burn scars here, there's a lot of area that unfortunately does have that probability for some of those mudslides as we head over the next few hours. Meantime, taking you here to northern Colorado, just the north of Grand Lake, this storm putting down about quarter-sized hail just a short while ago. This now moving north of Grand Lake as we speak in Jackson and Grand counties. And then the foothills, if you're watching from Conifer, Evergreen on north, just about Golden and Morris, we've got some showers and some thunder showers moving through that region. We'll see those storms spread into northern Colorado tonight. Larimer, Weld County's best chance for a storm this evening. And then tomorrow, those storms turn a lot more widespread. There's going to be a lot of water with these storms tomorrow as well. A bit of a flash flood risk. And that'll continue into tomorrow night and into Thursday as well. Another wave of storms on Thursday and a Thursday night before things dry out and warm up for the weekend. Close look in at the metro area again. Late tonight, it does get a bit stormy in northern Colorado with some thunder showers up by Fort Collins and Greeley. And then a better chance for some showers and storms tomorrow afternoon and tomorrow evening. Storm odds increase as we head over the next couple of days, and then we dry out and we really warm up this weekend before some of those monsoon storms return early next week. So a brief break from the monsoon this weekend, at least in Denver and along I-25, before again those showers and storms return next week.
A trip to the grocery store is getting more and more expensive. One nonprofit is helping families access healthy groceries at no cost. And a reminder, you can catch all Next streaming, even when the guy doesn't look like who it is on screen right there. You can see it 6 p.m. everywhere you watch, and the dulcet sounds of Marshall's voice wherever you get your podcasts. I'm sure many of you are watching us from your kitchen table right now. It's where meals are shared, stories are told, and newscasts are still watched. In a Denver neighborhood, one program is making sure more families have the food and the support they need. Our Byron Reed has the story.
Community starts at the kitchen table.
It's very good food, very much needed.
For James Manning and his sons, Jaden, James, and Isaiah, this space hits home after having no place of their own.
We were on the streets for about 90 days.
They're at the Sun Valley Kitchen and Community Center in Denver, where residents aren't just here for food, they're here for a connection.
I'm just extremely grateful and gracious, and my children are precious, so I want to try to do the best I can for them.
Manning and his sons are at the center for their neighborhood-based no-cost grocery program that serves 50 to 60 households twice every week, providing fresh food, pantry staples, and hot meals for families.
And this is how we provide community to our neighbors, is gathering them at the table.
Nick Tallarico is the executive director of Sun Valley Kitchen, where a sense of belonging is important in this historically low-income neighborhood.
Our residents know that there is something here that they can come to regularly, that they know we're going to be here, and that they know they're going to get fresh produce to take home.
The grocery program is supported in part through the city's Healthy Food for Denver's Kids initiative, created to address food insecurity and improve access to nutritious food for children and their families.
In 2025, more than one in three adults reported cutting or skipping meals because they didn't have enough money for food.
Lauren Howe is the city's program supervisor for Healthy Food for Denver's Kids. She says the funding helps provide culturally relevant foods to families in need.
The Healthy Food for Denver's Kids program is funded by sales tax revenue. The Denver voters approved this initiative in 2018. And since then, we've distributed more than $100 million to over 100 organizations.
Peaches, mango.
For the Mannings, living in a neighborhood where food access can be a challenge, the groceries matter, but so does the community that comes with them.
Without it, I would be struggling way more than what I am right now.
For Next,
I'm just trying to raise my boys and do the best job that I can as a single father.
I'm Byron Reed.
Howe says last year, Healthy Food for Denver's Kids and their partners served more than 100,000 families in the city. We should mention you helped raise money for Sun Valley. Next Word of Thanks campaign in June raised $54,000 to help feed families. Zvivac, I like that from yesterday. I've been compared to Brains from, I don't know, the 80s. I sound like Bob the Tomato, and
yes,
apparently,
yes.
I don't know. And we've got one new one here. All right, I'm not too sensitive about the first one. I've been compared to several characters over the years. One of them is Brains from Thunderbirds. I've been told I sound like Bob the Tomato from VeggieTales. I don't know anything about it. Zvi agrees with it right now. And today, I've been told over text that when I don't shave, I look like Red Skelton, the comedian from the 60s. I think that this is the TV personality, radio and TV personality, Red Skelton. Mallory in my ear is telling me I probably look like the hobo character he's done. I'll have to check it out. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to the podcast version of Next. Catch us live weeknights at 6 Mountain Time on 9 News, streaming live same time on 9 News Plus. Email me anytime at next@9news.com. Next producer is Mallory Harris. Our digital producer is Marilyn Moore. Our visual editor is Jeff Sartell. Our reporters include Marshall Zellinger, Mark Salinger, Angeline McCall, and Evan Kruel. Misty Montano is 9 News' digital director. I'm Kyle Clark. I'll see you next time.